Thank you. My name's Teresa Cordero. I'm an alcoholic. I heard the program said Cordova, but that's not it. So it's good to be here. It's good to be sober. Thank you so much for inviting me, whoever invited me. Thanks. It's good to be here. Don't you love that countdown? I just love that. It just gets me right here, you know. Language of the heart. And here we are, trying to stay sober day at a time. It's good to see some old friends. I do mean old. Just kidding. No, Joe, we have the same, I know him from Santa Barbara, and we have the same exact sobriety date, which is March 5th, 1983.
Wow!
I know, we're so old, huh? And Cora, I've known Cora for 30 years or so, but it's crazy, you know, you stay here a day at a time, and the weeks turn into months, months turn into years, and here we are. Oh, I have an accent. I'm originally from Massachusetts, not from Santa Barbara. But what we read tonight in the Armistice, talking about Armistice Day, when Bill went off on another bender, I heard him talk, I heard a CD of him in this talk, and in this little story he tells is, he's gonna go, he's got, I don't know, a little bit of sobriety, a couple days, a couple weeks, I forgot what he said he had. And he tells Lois, I'm gonna go to the golf course, go to the golf club where his brother-in-law belongs. His brother-in-law was the doctor, Leonard Strong. And he's gonna go to his country club and play around the golf. And Lois is all, think that's a good idea, Lois? He's like, yeah, I'll be fine. So he gets his golf bag and he gets on a bus to go to the golf country club. And on the bus, a guy comes on the bus with a gun, like a rifle. And I guess you can do that in New York City in those days. Nobody really, I mean, people walked around with guns. Maybe he was going hunting, I guess. And so Braille, of course, strikes up a conversation with this guy. And he's like, yeah, I'm going hunting. Oh, I'm going to play golf. And Bill, for some reason, starts telling him about what a bad drunk he is. Like, he's such a bad alcoholic. Yeah, I haven't worked in a long time. And I just have such a terrible time with alcohol. And I've quit. I'm off the booze for good, forever, he's telling this guy. So then the bus breaks down. So then they go to the, you know, this little bar, lunch diner place to get lunch while they're fixing the bus. And Bill orders a drink, and just like that. And I get that, I know that, you know? And after he just tells this guy his whole life story about his alcoholism, the guy's like, what are you doing? You just told me you quit drinking and this is what happened to you and you've been in the nut house and you've been in the hospital. What are you doing? Bill's like, yep, that's what I do, you know? And that's what I do. You know, I've been drunk, you know, you have your bad nights and your good days and like, you know, you wake up in the morning and go, oh man, I gotta quit drinking, right? They ever say, oh man, I gotta quit. No, I never said I was an alcoholic. I just said, oh man, I gotta quit drinking. Then by 4 o'clock, I'm drinking all the time. I didn't have a program. It wasn't an AA. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. So anyway, I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is divine in its purpose and human in its organization. Its purpose is to point you towards God and a better way of life. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the best, single most important thing I've ever done in my whole life. You know, and I've been married, I have kids and grandkids, and just this is by far the most important thing that I've ever done in my whole life. And if you're new, I hope you stay. It's like the guy who gave you the book said, it's a lot of ups and downs, it's a lot of experiences, but we need each other. I hope you stay. And welcome to AA. You know, we don't have it doesn't seem to me like we have as many newcomers as we used to. I don't know, I guess they're going to young people meetings maybe, I don't know. But can you open it? Thank you. So, you know, I it was good to know what was finally wrong with me. You know, because, you know, it was dark, it was dirty, it was gritty. That was my life. It was just like one chaotic thing after another. One arrest, I got arrested, and then I got arrested, and then I got arrested, and then I got arrested. I'm like, you know, a lot of DUIs, a lot of drunk driving charges. Fortunately, it was back in the late 70s, early 80s, so, I mean, if it were now, I'd still be in jail probably, right, because of the way it is now with all the stuff. They really frown on DUIs now. So, and I just thought, man, I gotta quit driving. You know, I'm not gonna quit drinking. No way, there's no way. I just, the thought of not drinking wasn't an option. And you know, I really don't have You know, when I was in school, they showed us these films like of, you know, the dangers of drugs and smoking and all this stuff, and they were showing people, you know, did a little film maybe on LSD, and I couldn't wait, where do I get some? It was no deterrence, like, where do I get it? And I found it, I got it, at 13 years old, I did my first hit of LSD. 13 years old, I started smoking weed, as they call it now, started smoking pot. And that's when I had my first drink at 13 years old, and I'm, you know, I'm a skinny kid, braces, glasses, and I'm just like so self-centered, so into myself. And like, I know everybody's looking at me, I know everybody's talking about me all the time. And when I had that first drink at 13, it was like, ooh, wow, what a relief. It did it for me, you know, and I think that's what makes me an alcoholic. It's not all the DUIs, it's not the drug arrest, it's not this, it's not that. It's because alcohol did so much for me. When I took a drink of alcohol, I'm like, wow, this is great. You know, and I go, wow, no wonder Dad drinks. My father was a daily drinker. And we, you know, I had a great childhood. I had no problems, you know. And in these films they showed us in high school, it's like, oh, people drink to escape their problems and escape whatever. And I'm like, well, because I tried to figure out later on, why do I drink so much? Why do I do this? And it was just because it feels good. It makes me happy. It does, you know, it does the trick. It takes away that fear and anxiety. It was like full of fear, full of anxiety all the time. And I don't know why, but I know when I drink, it takes it away. And so for me, when, you know, later on, my mother's telling me I'm an alcoholic, I'm like, oh my God, shut up. You know, really. She essentially moved to LA. I was living in LA at the time. She left Massachusetts. Drove 3,000 miles because I was circling the drain. And what happened there was, I was doing a little bit of LSD. I was drinking a little vodka and smoking a little pot with these two guys that I met at the beach. That I said, "Hey, let's go to my house and party," because there were too many cops on, you know, the boardwalk in Santa Monica. I said, "Hey, why don't you come over to my house and party?" And one of them stayed for 2 years. And it worked out good. I had a job. I was a legal secretary working on a high rise in Century City. And he had a good job. He had the drugs, and he had a good job at the Santa Monica Pier working at the bumper cars. And it was a match made in heaven. But come to find out later on, he was a runaway wanted for armed robbery from Arizona. And the name that he told me wasn't even his name. So this is the stuff I'm doing, just crazy shit, you know, crazy stuff. And hanging around Venice Beach, I'm just lucky to be alive. So anyway, he had some really good LSD one time, and I started doing it in high school, and I stopped doing it for a long time once I moved to California, because, you know, I didn't know the source, really. So, well, you know, first, before I left Massachusetts, a couple of things happened. I got married. Which I didn't want to do, but it was one of those things. You know, I've heard the story before. I got married because the invitations were out. The invitations were out, and I'm a people pleaser, and I can't say no. I can't, like, rein it back in. It's too late. We gotta go. Come on, Ma, let's go. And the day of my wedding, she's like, "Honey, you don't have to do this." I'm like, "Are you kidding? Let's go. We're going. They're at the church. We can't disappoint the people." So I went, and, you know, and he's putting the ring on my finger, and I'm crying, and they weren't tears of joy. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to do this, you know? I know. So then we went to this fabulous honeymoon in Bermuda, and I was like, oh my God, the rest of my life with this guy, I'm like, ah. I know, it's so dumb. Give me a drink, right? So that lasted about, let's see, I was married in October, and I remember it was October because it was Halloween, the only reason I remember. And I left on New Year's Eve that same year. So I know my poor parents, they spent all this money. It was a Cinderella wedding. It was a beautiful wedding. Oh, and I told myself, I'm not going to drink at my wedding. I don't know why. It was like, I guess it was a problem. I guess I had issues, but I'm not sure why. But I said, okay, I'm not going to drink at my wedding. So then I go, but I'm an alcoholic, which I don't know. And I'm like 21-ish, I guess, when I got married that first time. And I said, okay, well, I'm just going to have one. It's my way, I'm just gonna have one. I mean, have you ever said that to yourself? I'm just going to stop for one or two, and like, it doesn't work out for me. So I shuffle on up to the bar and, you know, order a drink and get my money. I brought my money with me. He goes, oh, it's free for the bride. That's kind of one of the last things I remember. Did we take pictures? I don't know. And so I left before. It was violent, you know, it was a violent thing. And I don't know what was going on, but he like strangled me and stuff like that. And there were no broken bones or anything, but it was violent, you know. So I left for the third and last time on New Year's Eve. Yeah, so between October and December, I left and came back three times. And I just, you know, I just want to die. You know, I was like so depressed and sad, and I just wanted to die. So I, this last time when it happened, I called the police. And the police came. Oh, I wanted to just kill myself. I was going to sit in the car in the garage, turn the key on, you know, turn the car on and just let the fumes put me out, you know. And I thought, well, that won't work, because I saw him in there. He was peeking around the corner in the window of the garage, and I saw, well, as soon as I pass out, he's going to come and kill me himself. So I just like, I can't do that. So I'm going to crash through the bottom, like in the movies. I'm going to crash through the bottom of the garage door. And so I gunned it. And it was my mother. I was living at my mother-in-law's house at the time. We didn't have our own apartment or anything. So I just gunned it, and I crashed. It was just a wooden garage door, and just put a huge crack in the bottom of the garage door. And I was like, oh, whoops, I didn't do it hot enough. So just threw the car in park, and I just ran to the neighbors and called the police. And the police came, and they said, well, sorry, there's nothing we can do. We didn't see it happen. Oh, okay, so you have to physically see him strangle me. Okay, thanks for nothing. So anyway, yeah, I went home to my mother, and that was that. That was the end of that marriage, and I ultimately had that annulled. And it was like doing a fourth step with the priest. I said, well, yeah, this happened, and that happened, and I drank a lot. I was drinking at the time. So I had it annulled when I was after I was sober, because I wanted to get married in the church. So the priest was like, wow. You know, I'm telling him all this stuff. That's why you need to have it annulled. He's like, okay, you have very good grounds for that. So anyway, I've always wanted to live in California, and I'm not sure why, but I guess Haight-Ashbury was one of the main reasons. You know, I wanted to go, you know, Haight-Ashbury, the hippies and the love and all the drugs and stuff. But I missed it by about 10 years. I didn't come out here until early 80s, maybe. I'm not even sure what year I moved. I guess I can figure it out, but off the top of my head, I can't tell you. So it was like too late. And I ended up living in Hollywood. I first moved to Hollywood when I came to California. Oh, and the heat was on back east because, it's just another kind of a drunk story, but it's kind of funny. I was with my younger cousins. So I'm like 21 maybe, and they're 16 to 20-ish. They're all in that age range, you know. And we're going to a concert. I don't know if it was in Rhode Island, Connecticut, who knows. But, you know, from Massachusetts, we're going to drive there. And, like, all the states are, like, really close together, you know. It's not like California. We can drive days in the same state. In New England. So, anyway, I'm, like, really drunk, really stoned. I was tripping. I found some acid at the concert. And it was time to go. And I'm, like, really tripping and really drunk, really stoned. And I'm like, and I never said this. This is one of the things I never say. I'm like, hey, can anybody drive? Because I was like, I couldn't see. So they're like, no, I can't. They couldn't either. So they're like, can you just get us out of the parking lot and I'll take it from there. I get us out of the parking lot. That's the hard part. And I thought the car was moving and I hadn't even turned it on yet. And it was just, so anyway, off we go, and I had no business driving, no business. It was this little Ford Pinto. It was my first car that I ever had. So we're driving, and it's a lot of woods back there. You know, it's very woodsy. So I think I know where I am, and I got all excited. And then the next thing I know, though, I saw the lights come. Uh oh. So So we got pulled over and, you know, we opened the car doors and smoke's pouring out and beer cans are falling out. So we all got arrested. And they were going to let one of my cousins drive. I mean, this is how it was back there, you know, these little towns. They were going to let one of my cousins drive, but he didn't have his license with him. But so they arrested us all and our parents had to come get us. So it was one of those, that I didn't have a term for now, but it was one of those demoralizing situations. You know, incomprehensible demoralization. And I was just, I was embarrassed to death, you know, because my family's close. I saw my cousins a lot and my aunts and uncles, and it was like always, I want to put my head down. So I'm like, I got to get out of here. So that's what really prompted was the Haight-Ashbury and that coupled with that. And I'm like, I'm out. So somehow I had a cousin living in Hollywood, and somehow I met one of his friends, and somehow I ended up living with him. I don't even know how that all happened, but that's where I live. I moved to Hollywood, like right almost under the Hollywood sign, and it was everything I hoped it would be. And meanwhile, my brother's in the Navy in San Diego, so we got to see each other. My friend Ron, who I was living with, I guess he's kind of more than a friend, but I got a tattoo on one of my drunken benders with my brother down in San Diego, and I came home with a tattoo. He's like, oh, so mad. I'm like, what? It's just a little tree. My nickname's Tree. It's got a little tattoo on my arm. What's the big deal? And he just was very upset, and he was starting to complain about my drinking, too. And so my brother was here one time and visiting, and I knew he was at this bar down on Weston and Wilshire area. It's not a very good area. And I said, told Ron, I said, I'm going to go meet my brother and we're going to, you know, play pool and whatever. He's like, if you leave this apartment, don't come back. I said, okay, bye. And I left. I left. I'm going to go drink. You know, it's just that. And it wasn't, I don't know, it just seemed like it wasn't that important. But I was like, I don't know, don't tell me what to do. I'm going to drink. When I drink, I'm going to drink. And it didn't matter, you know, I mean, it didn't matter who I hurt, what you said, what you thought, it's just like, I'm doing what I'm doing. So anyway, I never really left, because as I turned the corner, as I left the apartment, my brother came around the corner, and he was coming home, so I never, technically didn't leave. But I knew that was the end. I was like, I can't, if somebody's going to complain about my drinking, I just can't stay, it's just too much. So, so I left that, I ended up moving, moved further west, moved to West LA, and then moved to Santa Monica in the end. So when I picked up those guys from the beach, one of them stayed for 2 years, we were really drinking, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I guess the music was really loud, and I was having a really bad trip, and, you know, I was drinking vodka, smoking pot, doing a couple of hits of acid. And the neighbors called the cops. And the cops came and they saw the booze and it's like, oh yeah, everything's okay. Yeah, we're good. Well, yeah, we'll turn the music down. It's all good. So they started to leave and I closed the door. And as soon as I closed the door, I felt like I was possessed, like Linda Blair in The Exorcist. And I thought they were the devil. I thought the two guys there were the devil. And I called the cops back. I said, wait, come back. These guys are the devil. Get a court, because I'm a legal secretary. Like, get the court reporter in here and take down their testimony. Ask them what they do. They're the devil. And the cops like, yeah. The cops are like, whoa. So the next thing I know, I was handcuffed to my living room chair. And they took me away and put me in a padded cell. They took me to their psychiatrist or doctor had looked at me first and said, okay, yeah, she's good to go in the padded cell, she's not going to die. So yeah, spent the night in a padded cell, and then they let me go at like 5:30 or 6:30 the next morning, and I don't know how, but I called my neighbor and I asked them to come pick me up, and they were still at my house partying. I kicked them out, took a shower, and went to work on my Century City high-rise law firm job. And I'm still tripping, you know, like still drunk, still like, ugh, sick, you know. But I'm going to show up. I think it's an East Coast thing. I'm going to show up. Now I think my boss is the devil. And I'm like, oh my God. So, and it just seems so real, you know. So I'm like, I gotta go. I just told him I gotta go. And on my way home, I don't have a car, so on my way home, I stopped at a church to tell a priest this story because I need help. I don't want to be possessed like Linda Blair. So I thought I was in trouble with the devil. So the priest said, well, were you on any drugs at the time? I'm like, oh yeah, but that doesn't matter. It was real, it really happened. So anyway, and I know when the cops were there, I just kept saying, can I call my mother? Can I call my mother? They're like, no, you can't call your mother. So I'm like, okay, whatever, so I need parrots, blah, 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 blah. So a week or two goes by and one of the guys is there, we're partying, and I have a flashback. We're drinking and smoking pot, and I get a flashback on that trip, which was the first time it ever happened to me. It never happened before. I'm like, well, I'm tripping. So, well, I think he's the devil again. So I threw him outside, locked the door, and I ran to the phone. I called my mother. I said, Ma, help. The devil's after me. And I said, wait a minute, hold on. I put the phone down. I ran into my bedroom, and I picked up the Bible, and I picked up the extension in my bedroom. I said, okay, I have the Bible. I'm safe now. Thanks. Bye. And I hung up. So that's why she moved to LA, to come take care of me when I'm like, I think I'm 22 now, maybe. And she packed up her little French poodle and trailer and drove 3,000 miles by herself to take care of me. So that's when, you know, we got an apartment together. She starts, like, she sees what's happening. It's like, oh my God, she's out of control. So I'm like, oh my God, shut up. Because Tommy, I'm an alcoholic. And I remember she used to tell my father he was an alcoholic. And I remember my father went to a meeting or two. And I don't know why, but I picture like, oh my God, poor dad. You know, like in the dark room with the old men and the light bulb, you know, the bare light bulb hanging down. That's what I thought it was. I'm not sure why. I was like, oh, poor dad. So now she's telling me I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't even know what an alcoholic was, really. Okay, walking home from school one day, I'm like 9 or 10 years old, and my neighbor's kind of hanging out in the gutter. And I said to my brother, I go, Bob, what's wrong with Dana? He said, oh, he's an alcoholic. I'm like, oh, that's an alcoholic. So I was confused. I'm like, why is Ma calling Dad an alcoholic? Dad's never in the gutter. Dad drank at home. Dad wasn't a bar drinker. So anyway, I was like so confused. Like, why, and Ma, why are you calling me an alcoholic? I mean, I fall down, but I get up. You know, I don't stay down. I pop right back up, and I carry on. And I was confused. Didn't know why. All I knew was it bothered me that she was saying I'm an alcoholic. I'm like, yeah. So anyway, so I did have a car. I finally had a car, but then I totaled my car, and now my mother's picking me up from the bars. I'm hanging out in Venice Beach, and I call my mother for a ride, and I'm like, okay, Ma, can you come get me? She's like, I'll be right there. You know, I'm 22, and she doesn't, you know, I was like, yeah, I'll come get you. How else am I going to get home? So by the time she gets there one night, I met a new friend, and we were going to go party, and I said, thanks for coming, Ma, but I'm going to go home with him. She's like, no, no, you're not. So I said, well, anyway, I ended up going home with her. And I guess I took a bottle of beer from the bar. And you know, I am an alcoholic, and I have the mental obsession and the physical allergy. And what that means for me is once I start drinking, I can't stop. Unless it's all gone, I'm out of money, or I'm in jail. that's how I'm gonna stop, or I pass out, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's like 2:30 in the morning, we're on our way home, we live in El Segundo by LAX. And we're stopped at a red light on Lincoln Boulevard, going towards the airport. And I'm like, you know, thanks for coming, Ma, but the Blue Lagoon's over here. Sometimes they let me in after hours. I'm gonna go see what's happening over there. And she's like, what? And I start to get out of the car, and we're struggling in the front. She's trying to hold me in. I'm trying to get out, and I finally break free, and I just start walking down the street. And I'm crossing Lincoln Boulevard at the light, and she got out of the car. She grabbed that bottle of beer out of my hands, and she smashed it in the street. And I said, oh my God, my last beer. I was so mad. I'm ready to fight her in the middle of Lincoln Boulevard. And cars are going by honking their horns, and we're in the middle of the street ready to go down, you know. And she was going to fight me back. I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? Call it my moment of clarity, my spiritual awakening, my surrender, if you will, which I believe we almost come to do at some point. we all have to surrender to this at some point. You got to say, I give up. So I didn't know it then, but that's what it was. And I just said, oh my God, what am I doing? This is my mother. I'm fist fighting my mother in the middle of Lincoln Boulevard. Just threw up my arms and said, okay, let's go. I started crying. I said, okay, let's go. And we got in the car and I called one friend that I knew I could, I mean, I don't know why, but I called him. I said, hey, you got to come get me. My mother's driving me crazy. And you know, I wasn't like, hey, kelp, I'm a drunk, I need help. I didn't say that. I said, my mother's driving me crazy, come pick me up. And so he lived in Venice and I'm in El Segundo, so it's not that long of a drive, you know, by LA standards. So he came and picked me up, and this guy happened to have 9 months of sobriety. He happened to have 9 months in the Pacific group on the west side.
Yeah.
And he said, all right, and he picked me up. I got some clothes together, and I just kind of crashed at his house. And the next day he said, I'm going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you go? I said, well, I'm not an alcoholic. He's all, okay. He was actually my cocaine connection. And when he got sober, I'm like, why are you going to AA? You don't even drink. He's like, yeah, well, it works for me too. You know, I'm cocaine addict. I said, whatever, it works. It's 12 steps, it works. So he's gone, I'm like, whatever, okay, I'll go. I don't know why I said yes, but I mean, well, I had nothing else to do, is why I said yes. And I didn't drink or use anything all day. And I went to this meeting, it was March 5th, 1983, my very first meeting, and I've been here ever since that meeting. And it was a huge room. It was, believe it or not, it was at the Federal Building on Wilshire Boulevard in Westwood. Huge room, like 450 people. And I'm not a people person. I do not like people. And, well, you're okay now, I find. You know, just because I think you're always judging, you know, and that fear that I had, like all the fear I was consumed with for so long. But now that I've done some work on myself, you guys aren't so bad. So I'm like, oh my God, all these people, and they're sober? What? These, really? Why? I didn't understand why you're sober. So it was like a bit like, ugh. So this woman brought me up to the literature table, and she was telling me about her drinking, and she worked in a law firm too. And she goes, yeah, and I used to go in the bathroom and shoot heroin on my breaks. I'm like, wow, really? That's so cool. I never did that. I really... really looked up to that, and I said, will you be my sponsor? And I didn't ask her that night. I thought about it for a day or two, and then I was like, wow, she's pretty cool. I'll ask her to be my sponsor. And she gave me the 20 questions. That was kind of the kicker. And I remember sitting down with my friend, well, with my mother at my friend Alan's house, who brought me to that meeting. And it's like, do you drink alone? Well, yeah, I do LSD alone. Who trips alone anyway? Yes. Yes, I drink alone. Are you in financial difficulty? Yes, I'm working on my fourth DUI. I got a lot of fines going on, lawyer fees, court fees, you know, all that. Do you miss work? Of course, who doesn't? Do you have a complete memory lapse? All the time. Like, is my car here? You know, did one of those walk down, oh, my car's here, yay. And then you walk around, right? Walk around your car looking for blood and dents and stuff. I mean, I thought that was so normal. Like, not everybody does that, apparently. So yes, 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 I said on these 20 questions. And on the bottom it says, if you're familiar with the 20 questions, it says if you answer yes, you might have a problem. You answer yes to two of these, you're probably an alcoholic. If you answer three, you're definitely an alcoholic. And I think I had 13 or 14 yes. And I said, Ma, look, maybe I'm an alcoholic. It was a revelation. It really was, which is weird because she'd been telling me for the last 2 years, Teresa, you're an alcoholic. And she, you know, she was very kind and loving. She was very kind and loving. She didn't say, of course, I've been telling you that for 2 years. She was like, yeah, honey, maybe you are. So that was it. That was my beginning. That was my journey in AA. And so I asked this lady to be my sponsor, and she said, I want you to get three commitments, go to like five meetings a week, say hi to two women. These were like the rules. The unwritten rules, this is not in the big book, these things. Say hello to two women you don't know at every meeting you go to. I'm like, why? I didn't ask her that. In my head, I'm going, why? Why would I do this? No, I'm not going to, but I did. And, you know, and I still try to do that today as a result of that, you know, and it took away my fear of people. So I got commitments, and I did what I was supposed to do. I, there was, the year I got sober, I think it was the 50th anniversary of AA or some jamboree happening down in Glendale or somewhere. And my group wrangled me into going to square dance lessons. They were going to do a square dance thing, this jamboree. I'm like, no, are you kidding? Square dancing? But I went. They dragged me. I went. And it was really fun. I had a good time. But I think, how lame. It's almost as lame as going to AA. Square dancing is lame, right? But it was fun. It was really fun. I started meeting people and got some friends. And we had the dating rules. You know, you don't. Not recommended that you date in your first year, but my sponsor did, so she said I could, so I did. But I had to maintain my women friends. You know, it's okay. And I could only see if I was dating, I use that term loosely, if I was dating someone, I could only see him for 3 nights a week. You know, I couldn't like glob on like I would normally, you know. It's like, okay, 3 days a week, I gotta maintain my life over here with regular people and, you know, we have women friends. And I have to go to the women's stag once a week. So I did all this stuff. And so when it didn't work out with the male prostitute that was sober and AA, that I had my women friends to fall back on. That was his former profession. He wasn't doing it at the time when we were in it. He was in AA. But that's what he used to do. So anyway, when things don't work out, I had my women friends to fall back on, and they were there for me, you know. So meanwhile, my brother is in LA, and he's circling the drain. I have this picture of Uncle Bob. I have kids, and I showed him this picture of him later on, and it was my first Christmas, and he was all sucked up, heroin addict. And I showed him this picture of us in front of the Christmas tree. They didn't even know who it was, didn't even look like him. So Bob saw how much fun I was having in AA. He came in, well, that was looking at a couple years, he was looking at time. The judge says, AA, or are you going to jail? So he's like, oh, I think I'll go to AA. So, but I had river rafting pictures on my wall. You know, I started doing all this stuff, going to Universal Studio, going to concerts, and I would never spend the money on that kind of stuff. You know, I just wouldn't. I mean, I lived in LA for so long, like for 3 years, and it was like I never left my block, pretty much, except to go to work, because I just wouldn't spend the money on any of that. So I started having a lot of fun. And then I met him. I met him down at Clancy's Yard, and he happened to be from Santa Barbara, so we started this long-distance relationship, and that's where I met Joe, up in Santa Barbara, and we ended up getting married after a year of long-distance dating, and we went up to Tahoe to get married in one of the Love Chapels. And it was really fun, and he put the ring on my finger, and I started crying, and it was because I was happy. It wasn't because I didn't want to do it. I really wanted to do it. And it was his second marriage, too, and so the only people who were there were my mother and my stepfather. And it was a fun wedding, you know, we had a great time. And then, so we were married for like 100 years. And he decided he didn't want to be married anymore. He traded me in for a younger model. And it was devastating. It was really, really heartbreaking. I'll tell you, it was the hardest thing I ever had to do. And my kids were older by now. I have two kids. I have a daughter and a son. And my daughter is the best in the world. My daughter's never smoked pot, ever. I mean, I think that's so weird. And my son was an alcoholic, or thought he was an alcoholic. His wife, who's married, and his wife gave him the ultimatum. I'm like, dude, you gotta quit drinking. You know, he was really out of control. And so he quit. And you know, it says in the book, faced with this or that, will, you know, if for illness or an ultimatum like your wife's gonna leave you, you'll quit drinking. So he did. He's like, hey, Mom, maybe you guys should write a story about me and put it in your book. I said, you're already in there. So, you know, and my sponsor, Mary McNally, at the time of my divorce, I'm like, Mary, how am I going to do this? And God bless her. I was at her house like every day crying. I'm like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to get through this? And she said, you know how, you know how you do it. And I did, I knew how. And, you know, and all else fails, work with another alcoholic. So I started going to more meetings. We have the tools. We're so lucky we have the tools here. I picked up that set of spiritual tools that are laid at my feet, and I was able to walk through that with dignity and grace. And you know what saved my life, too, was the third step prayer. you know, offered myself to the to build me to have meetings out. Well, relieve me of the bondage itself, and the bondage itself was here. Nothing physically was really wrong with me. It was just all in my head, all in my head, me again, right? Still all about, oh my, what am I gonna do? You know, so relieve me of the bondage itself. That's in my head, the bondage of self. So I might better do that. Well, so I can be an example to others that I got through this, so can they. And I've had examples go before me. I've seen people in the, like in the Pacific group, like one woman who, she just had a baby and her husband was cheating on her with a newcomer and got her pregnant. I'm like, oh my God, well, it could be worse. I could be her, you know. So, and I saw her walk through it as painful as it was. And I saw the, you know, the dread and pain on her face walking through it. You know, for me, the same, it was the same thing, but I showed up, and I'd show up to work, and I'd be crying at my desk at my law firm job here in Santa Barbara, still working at a law firm, and I'd show up at my law firm job crying, and my boss would come by and say, are you okay? I'd say, no, and he'd say, okay, and he'd turn around and just leave me alone, but I showed up, you know, because what's the alternative? I don't want to just sit home and think about me, you know, I got to go out and do stuff, and just when all else fails, you know, I work with another alcoholic, so, and my phone would ring and it would be a sponsor. I'm like, how are you? What's going on with you? You know, save me from myself. I'm thinking like, yay, a phone call. It's not about me. Oh gosh. So, you know, it was just blackness. But little by little, the veil started coming off and it got grayer, you know. And I started playing golf and I started doing this and that. And so things, the gray is gone. There's a little bit of light. Finally, there was light at the end of the tunnel and the tunnel was gone. And I'm like, happy, joyous, and free, yay. So yeah, that was a long time ago, but oh man, it was really, really bad. So you can do anything here and you can stay sober. You know, I really consider myself a high bottom drunk. And you know, you look at Bill Wilson and Bob Smith, okay, so his, you know, Bill got sober in the Oxford group, kind of, right? His friend Debbie was in the Oxford group, and he went and shared and said, hey, yeah, I got religion, you know, part in the book where he talks about how he had to go testify. The Oxford group people made him go do that, and Ebby's all, who can I talk to? He goes, oh, I know a real loser, Bill Wilson, I'll go talk to him. So he's the guy in the book who was sitting in his kitchen talking about, you know, I got religion, Bill, and Bill's like, whatever, my gin's going to last longer than your ranting. So Bill later on starts going to the Oxford group, and so was Dr. Bob. You know, Dr. Bob was doing the Oxford group in Ohio, and Bob wouldn't stay sober. Bob was in the Oxford group for years and couldn't stay sober, and they told him read spiritual literature, he did. They said join a church, he did. And they, you know, he read every day. Bill or Dr. Bob read like for an hour every day. Whether it was spiritual literature or not, I'm not sure. But he read, and he's an avid reader. And Dr. Bob says later, and there's a pamphlet, I work at Central Office, so I get a chance to read this stuff. So there's a pamphlet in Central Office of the co-founders of AA, and he said, I did everything they said to do, except they didn't tell me to be of service. And that is the kicker for me. When all else fails, you work with another alcoholic, because if I'm thinking about you, I can't be thinking about me, because I am my biggest problem. You know, my problem centers in the mind. There's nothing physically wrong, you know. Even if my house burnt down, if I'm in fit spiritual condition, my house can fall down in earthquake. Not that I want it to. Don't, you know, I'm not saying that it'd be a good thing or anything, but no matter what happens, I know I'll be okay. As long as I'm in fit spiritual condition. And, you know, I pray and I meditate, and I love meditating. You know, whether it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes, I set my little timer. You know, I'm staying at the hotel here, and I'm like, I keep wanting to say, Alexa, what time is it? But Alexa's not here. So I have to actually look at my phone. But I just set my, you know, timer and say, Alexa, play meditation music for 10 minutes, and it's just so awesome. I just love that. I get the feeling of the love and joy, you know. And it's the experience, and, you know, there's all these gems in the book. You know, I love the part about the gaunt prospector who finally strikes gold. He's starving. He finally strikes the mother lode. And now he's like, okay, I got it all to myself, but okay, now that you've had a little taste of it all, you got to give it away. You know, so it's important for us to share it. And our experience is what makes this work too, you know. What was I reading? I guess in the book too, it says our experience is like If we learn from the past how bad it was and share it and learn from it, then it's like a gem. It's like priceless things to have. They're life-saving things. And one of the things, like, I think I was 3 years old before I read The Power, willingness is the key, that one little sentence, willingness is the key. And I'm like 3 years old, I go, wow, I guess I must have been willing. And my life, as early as page 20, you know, if you look at the book, I think all throughout it talks about working with others and how we shouldn't think about ourselves so much. So as early as page 20, it talks about, one of my favorite lines is, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others. Constant thought of others? Well, for me, it saved my life when I was going through my divorce. Really, I just wanted, really wanted to kill myself. So, okay, constant thought of others. My life depends on my constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs, right? And then practical experience, the chapter working with others, practical experience shows, so this is Bill and Bob, you know, their experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It's all through the book. It's all about working with other people. For me, really, it saved my life. So intensive work with other alcoholics. And this is the bright spot of our lives, to see others grow up about us and make a host of new friends. This is the bright spot of our lives. And then when I first read that, I'm going, is it though? Really? No, but it is now. And you know, and so yeah, I went back to school. I got my paralegal degree at UCSB, and I was a paralegal for many years. And oh, you know what? I was a defendant in a case. I just got the verdict in today by mail. I won defense verdict. I cut down my hedge, my 100% on my property. My neighbor sued me. Goes, hey, you took away the hedge. I'm like, yeah, so it's mine. It'll grow back. So she took me to small claims court. I'm like, what the heck? So being a paralegal, my statement of facts and, you know, conclusion, well, you know, laid it all nicely and submitted it. So yeah, I got the verdict today. I won. Yeah, thanks. But I could have appealed if I didn't. I could have appealed. But so why was I telling you that? I don't know. Oh, went to paralegal school. I worked for paralegal for many years. So I retired for that. And now I'm the manager at Central Office in Santa Barbara. And what a great job that is. So Joe was asking me if I'm going to retire. Why would I retire? It's such a great job. So fun. I get to write the newsletter. I get to sell books and chips and all kinds of stuff and visit with alcoholics that come in every day. So I'm in it, you know, I'm always in. I'm in the middle of the herd, as they say. And, you know, I just saw a guy, I mean, people go out all the time and it breaks my heart. This guy just stood up at my Friday night meeting last night as a newcomer, and he had like at least 10 years. And, you know, I wonder why. When I was doing that square dancing thing around that time when I was new, there was this guy who had 3 years of sobriety and he went out. He was the first person I knew that went out when I was new. He had 3 years and he went out. He goes to a lot of meetings. I see him at every meeting I go to. I'm going to a lot of meetings. He's always there. I think he has commitments. And he drank them, like, and it scared me. And I thought, well, it's kind of like Jim in the book. You know how Jim was the, he lost the car dealership. Now he's working for the car dealership. I think Jim had a resentment that he didn't work on, right? He was doing maybe steps 1, 2, and 3, but didn't quite do 4 and 5. So resentment's the number one offender, right? They'll kill us. So I don't know, who knows, but you know, these things, I just watch for these things. And I know resentments are a luxury I can't afford to have. And I get to do the steps and I get to get rid of my resentments and work on them and work on my character defects, which I have now. I know that I have character defects and I work on them, but when I was new, I didn't have any, so I guess I got them here. But you know, I didn't know what a character defect was. Anyway, I think that's about it, huh? You guys done? All right, I am. Thank you. Thank you for having me.